watching Global Investor on Business Day TV. I'm Stephen Gagnon. Simon Brown from Just One Lap joins me this evening to guide us through all the latest news on global markets. Later in the show, we'll also be joined by Nicholas Kirridge from Schroders to discuss the APSA Global Value Feeder Fund. All that coming your way shortly. First, though, a quick look at what's been making the headlines. Lender Wells Fargo has agreed to pay $1 billion in penalties on a record fine relating to abusive practices in its auto and mortgage businesses between 2005 and last year. Last year, the bank uncovered inconsistencies at its auto lending and mortgage business and blamed a third-party vendor for wrongly layering insurance policies on its auto borrowers. News of the settlement sent Wells Fargo shares higher on Friday. New programming has attracted Netflix 7.4 million new customers just between January and March this year. The streaming service has signed up more than half of all U.S. broadband households and saw its customer ranks swell to 125 million by the end of March. Netflix is spending up to $8 billion on global TV shows and movies this year and is reportedly looking to buy its own series of movies theaters as it faces growing competition from Amazon and Apple, who are also investing in premium programming. And Amazon's chief executive officer, Jeff Bezos, told shareholders that the internet giant now has more than 100 million Prime members globally. Until now, Amazon has kept its Prime subscriber number a closely held secret, forcing analysts to estimate the figure based on shopper surveys. Here's more.
Amazon shares rose after the company's CEO Jeff Bezos said it now has 100 million Prime members globally. That rise came on top of more than a 70% upturn in the last 12 months. Benchmark Investments, Kevin Kelly.
I think this is an important signal from Jeff Bezos. They've been very closely guarded in that to the Prime number. And I think what he's saying, hey, listen, Alexa is a driver and it's leading to more Prime memberships.
In a letter to shareholders, Bezos also said that Prime Now, a service that offers free delivery within 2 hours, is now available in more than 50 cities spanning 9 countries. Analysts across brokerages prized Amazon's ability to cross-sell and fend off competition. Retail analyst Trey Budge.
I think for brick-and-mortar or omni-channel retailers, like, say, a Walmart or a Target, they still have a lot of options in terms of competing with Amazon because they have those stores that they can bring consumers into and offer great customer service and other bells and whistles that Amazon cannot. However, for strictly online retailers like a Wayfair or an Overstock, I think they have a lot of competition here and they have to be really creative in order to compete adequately with Amazon.
Some analysts say Netflix could be the next casualty. Amazon is spending more and more on video content, but for now, Netflix leads with its 125 million subscribers.
Well, Simon Brown from Just One Lap joining me now, and we can get to Amazon in just a moment. Maybe look at the broader market, because we have seen U.S. 10-year Treasury yields almost at 3%, in fact 2.9826% this evening. And I think that's worrying some investors in the market, particularly as it becomes more competitive against equities, then you could see money flowing out of equities back into bonds.
Evening, Stephen. That's exactly the story. Now, the rates are obviously going up because interest rates are going up in the U.S. The Fed has signaled that. They've been pushing rates now for over a year, and we're looking at probably a minimum of 3 rate increases for 2018 and forward. And you're right in the sense that, you know, what does a bull market die? It dies on high interest rates, because, you know, if I can go and buy a 10-year U.S. Treasury and guarantee, let's go far forward, 6 or 7%, mm-hmm. say, why go for equity? Equity is going to give me maybe 7 or 8, but with risk, no. That it might give me a minus number. Sure, it might give me 15, but it might also give me minus. So, you know, every bull market dies on the high, on increasing interest rates. And this is definitely the early signs of the beginning of the end of our bull market. But I stressed the early signs part, because we're away still from normalized rates, never mind moving into high territory. But it is that very early sort of canary in the coal mine. And certainly, there are some investors out there, particularly those fixed income and the like, who are able to go back into the market, who had gone into equities and other asset classes, mm-hmm. simply because your yield was nothing if you went into treasuries or anything like that. So you will see slowly more and more money moving in, and that money is largely exiting equity. At this point, it's no concern, but it does tell us that the market is maybe in a sense that we're kind of moving back to normalcy after 10 years of sort of post-crisis markets.
Mm. Well, in the meantime, we're in the middle of the latest reporting season. In fact, U.S. earnings blizzard this week was one of the headlines. And I think we have Facebook, Amazon, and Alphabet reporting this week, so much-watched FANG companies. So far, have they lived up to expectations?
They have. Earnings growth has been slightly ahead of expectation, although truthfully that's because the companies manage expectation well. But coming in at high double teens, if you take the S&P 500 PE, it's a little light in that regard, and you would like them higher at that point. But for this point of the cycle, that's what we're expecting. The numbers are looking good. We're getting positive earnings coming through, and not just 3% positive earnings, proper positive mm-hmm. earnings coming through.
Has there been a kicker from the Trump tax cut?
So I think a few tickers. One of them, absolutely, the Trump tax cut. Not massive. We had the hit in the first quarter. Now we're seeing, in the end of last year, and we're seeing the benefit from the first quarter. But I think we're also basically getting improvement from a broadly improving global economy. We have had global GDP numbers upgraded, not massively, but Europe's starting to come to the party. Parts of Asia, South America, and the like are coming to that party as well. And when we look at the S&P 500, whilst these are American domicile companies, they're obviously global companies. Yeah. The ones you mentioned, Google, etc. Sure, a large amount, if not a majority of their profits are from within the borders of America, but they're very much earning significant chunks from beyond those borders. So that tailwind of general global growth continues to feed into them. And then the Trump tax cuts. I think it's more global growth than just tax cuts, but certainly together that they're helping the numbers.
Yeah. Okay, so we had that story about Amazon in the news. 100 million Amazon Prime subscribers. This is a share that's rallied 33% this year, so it has been doing pretty well. More to come after the results?
I think so. I mean, pause a moment. 100 million subscribers, you pay $99 each, or the equivalent if you're in the UK or something. That's 10 billion that you start your year with.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of JC.
And it's annuity income.
It's annuity, and I'm trying to think of JC companies that have it. And I know people who are on Prime. So what does Prime do? You that free delivery for two-day delivery, although truthfully sometimes it's quicker if it can be. They've got their own sort of Netflix service and a bunch of other services around it. And it gives you a 100 million is it's almost every household in America, notwithstanding they didn't break it up into geographic regions, and it's not in many other regions. Mm-hmm. But it's a vast majority of American households, and it's the convenience. Things that we randomly order, that we hate having to buy on a regular basis, cleaning products and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
People just put it on order. They speak to their Echo device and just say, hey, Echo, order me whatever, and it somehow happens, and at no delivery. So it's a huge number for them. And if I was trying to compete with them, I'd be terrified, because that's just your base. Then there's me and you and everyone else who doesn't have Prime. So they've probably got, a multiple of that interpreter. Customers, these are loyal customers, and everyone I speak to in the States, they all have Prime, and I say, $100, big money. They said, could be $200. I would still take it in a flash.
Mm. Would you be buying Amazon shares ahead of the results?
At this point, yeah, I think so, because I think you remember the days when Amazon wasn't making money, and there was debates, and we can go all the way back to the 90s and early 2000s, and even just 3, 4, 5 years ago, is this really happening? And now they're starting to make money, and if we look at things such as Kindle, and we don't have numbers on that, but their Kindle store probably generates a vast amount as well. They've got the 100 million Prime users and the like. Amazon is an absolute machine, and if anything, a few weeks ago they mentioned that they were thinking of going into sort of medical, not the hospital side, the prescription side, and stocks in America sort of that would be competing against lost 30 billion just on a rumor that this upstart who has no experience in this business was coming. So Amazon ahead of results, absolutely, because the results are almost certain to in enough places impress and see that price higher.
Okay, Netflix, that share up, I think, over 70% this year already, and last week reporting 125 million subscribers, and just 7.4 million in the first quarter alone.
And it's a giant number, and the company was there, their stretch target was 5 million, and they're constantly beating their stretch target. The key point is they've now expanded into 180 or 90 countries. We can get Netflix almost anywhere, and that's had a huge impact on them. Ironically, their biggest competitor, in a sense, is probably Amazon with the Amazon Prime. We've also got their challenges, and they did a price increase last year, the first in many, many years, and there was no sense of slowdown from that. There was concerns that the increase would see some tapering off in demand. Didn't happen at all. They're still signing up. They didn't see any attrition, but they need to spend, and they're spending, you know, $8 billion, $6 billion on creating content, buying content, moving into cinema houses, although that's more because in order to sort of be in the Oscars, you have to have been in a screen, and therefore there's just an easier way to make it happen. Yeah. It's a brilliant company. It's a brilliant model. The money they need to spend is going to be going forever and a day. They can never stop spending, and that's fine. They've got the annuity, and they've got those 125 million people paying them between $6 and $10, $12 a month, mm-hmm. depending on geography. The trick is the valuations on the stock are out the park and back some. I mean, they almost make Tesla look cheap.
Okay, and so one company that hasn't probably been moving fast enough with the times is Mattel, the toy maker. Lost its fourth CEO in as many years, and I think Margaret Georgiadis stepping down after just 14 months, and I think that share price has halved in value over the last year since she's been the CEO.
And it's trading back at levels not seen in 20 years. And a couple of things happened. They lost some big contracts with Disney, and now Disney obviously do the movie tie-ins, and those have been, if you get the right movie and the right tie-in with it, that is just, you know, easy money, and they lost a bunch on that side. But there's a shift also in how kids play. When we were kids, it was go outside and play with a bicycle or a stick or whatever it was.
Take your action man or your...
Yeah, and you put your you probably had one and you guarded it. Now kids are playing on mobile. They're much more in the mobile space. A lot more money has been spent in that space. So in part, perhaps some internal issues with it, but I think also just a general shift on how kids play and what they do. If you remember back in the 90s, it would always be like a toy of Christmas, and you know, some company would sell literally tens of millions of it. We still have those toys of Christmas, but they...
Kids want airtime.
They want airtime. They want iTunes vouchers and that sort of thing. Interestingly, the new person who's coming in, he has sold his previous two businesses to Disney, and the sense is that maybe they're looking for an exit, and one of those exits could be a sale to Disney to perhaps try and take it in-house to help with competitors such as Netflix.
Buying opportunity from Mattel? Would you be buying it?
No, I would not. I would not. The corporate activity might happen, but if it happens in a year's time, that price could have halved again, and then your premium just basically takes you to where you are now. Those old legacy businesses need really, really astounding CEOs to make them happen, and they've struggled. They've shown that the board has struggled to find that right CEO, and not dissing the new person, but I wouldn't be putting pennies into that.
Okay, we have to leave it there for a moment. We're going to a short break. When we come back, we take a look at the APSA Global Value Feeder Fund, and that's with Nicholas Kirridge from Schroders. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back. You're watching Global Investor. Still with me in studio, Simon Brown from Just One Lap. Joining us on the line from London to discuss the APSA Global Value Feeder Fund is Nicholas Kirridge from Schroders. Nicholas, thanks very much for chatting to us this evening. So this is actually a Schroders managed fund, which you do on behalf of APSA clients. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Tell us a little bit about it. Global Value Feeder Fund, are you finding value in this market?
I think it's a fund that's looking to do something genuinely different from other products. We have a heritage within Schroders and within the Schroder Value team of looking for deep value stocks, really out of favor companies, which have fallen on hard times for cyclical or structural reasons and trade at very, very heavy discounts to their intrinsic valuations. And this is a fund that's looking to genuinely be as benchmark unconstrained as possible and look at those kind of deep value investments.
Okay. So to take us through a couple of those deep value investments, because your third biggest holding is Anglo American, which is a company most South African viewers will be familiar with. Are you seeing deep value in there? I watched an interview with you a couple of years ago where you weren't very favorable towards resources stocks, and yet you do have a couple of resources stocks is it just because of the deep value you're seeing in a couple of those?
Yeah, I think you've got to differentiate between when resources are attractive. So resources have been in or out of, you know, been up and down like a yo-yo over the last kind of 10 years. And what we would say is only for probably the last two or three of those years have they genuinely fallen to levels where we think they're attractive. Investors have an occupational hazard of looking out about 6 months when they're trading resources businesses, but these are assets that last for decades. And so you really benefit as an investor from trying to look at them in more of a 10, 20-year type cycle and ask, are they cheap in that context? And I think we believe today stocks like Anglo American, South32, some of the other resources businesses are cheap in that kind of long-term time frame.
Nicholas, Simon here, Anglo, South32, both diversified. Is that a particular point? Are you preferring diversified over sort of a single commodity resource stock, or is that just where the market is giving opportunity at this point?
It just happens to be where the market's giving opportunity. Over time, we have owned stocks like Lonmin, we do own Impala. These are businesses which are exposed to a particularly out-of-favor commodity in platinum. At different points in the last 5 years, other stocks have come across our radar, things like gold and coal. But typically, we found that some of the heaviest discounts are actually in large diversified businesses. And actually, that's very attractive because those businesses tend to be more enduring, have longer track records, and have greater ability to protect themselves when things go wrong through cutting costs and shoring up their balance sheets.
So if you're in it for the long term with stocks like these, I presume you're looking at a long history of earnings rather than judging them on most recent earnings reports, which might make you change your investment approach.
Yeah, I think that's exactly true. So when people talk about valuations for commodity stocks, they sometimes talk about spot valuations. You know, a stock looks cheap on this year's earnings. But, you know, what we've seen over the last 10, 15 years is this year's earnings could be up 400% or down 95%. And so this year really is slightly meaningless in the context of the long term. When we're looking at the profits of these companies, we are looking at 20-year average commodity prices and simply saying, what is the level of profits and cash that a company can generate if I assume reversion to a long-term commodity price? Why would we do that? Because these industries have decades and decades of evidence to suggest that eventually commodity prices return to long-term real averages.
Nicholas, interestingly, your biggest holding is actually 5.2% in Schroders funds, and these are short-term bonds. Are you using this as a cushion for the portfolio?
We're not doing it as an asset call. We're simply using it for flexibility to move as and when we see opportunities to invest in stocks. So the fund can hold up to 10% in cash, and we do that 5% as a maximum in cash on balance sheet and 5% in liquidity type funds, of which the biggest holding is a liquidity fund. But we aren't looking to make an asset call there. We're simply waiting for better opportunities, and as and when they come along, we'll very quickly move that into stocks.
Anyway, are you seeing opportunities at the moment?
I think one of the greatest areas for opportunity globally is in banking, probably. Outside of commodities, which are also very cheap. Banking has an interesting confluence of factors. You know, on the one hand, it's a sector that continues to be very out of favor, trading at very low valuations versus history and versus the intrinsic value of assets, which look a much more reasonable reflection of reality today than they did 5 or 10 years ago. So that's positive. On the other side, we also have much bigger levels of safety than we've ever had before, with many banks now trading at 40-year high levels of capital. So aside from also being amongst the cheapest sectors in the world, they're perhaps some of the best prepared for any negative environment that might come along in the future. And with stock markets having gone up for the last 7, 8 years, that's a nice balance to have. And they represent around 25% of our portfolio diversified across 7 or 8 individual banks globally.
Nicholas, one of the, I mean, Wells Fargo getting a fine last week, not in your top 10 holding, and a fine for a recent activity they were doing. One of the issues post the crisis of now a decade ago was banking fines coming through. Is that now pretty much out the system and behind the banks?
Yeah, we'd like to think so. I mean, they've been bled dry, haven't they, by a series of fines, much of which was, it was right that they pay for past misdemeanors. I think we're now starting to come to the end of that. Though what I would say is we're not making an investment call predicated on that being the sole reason we'd invest. I think I see a parallel here with other industries that went through a prolonged period of litigation and troubles, and whilst that hasn't totally disappeared, they eventually were no longer the drag on the shares that perhaps they had been initially. So tobacco's is perhaps a great parallel, where you went through a prolonged period where regulatory uncertainty and litigation overhung that sector, and as that abated slightly, it was obviously one aspect of the positive catalyst that drove tobacco to be such a powerful and strongly shareholder rewarding sector over the 2000s.
Nicholas, your regional allocation seems to be very much out of kilter with your benchmarks. So you have 57% in Europe and just about 27% in the Americas, whereas I think your benchmark, which is the MSCI World, probably has more than 50% in America. Are you seeing better opportunities in Europe than you are in the U.S.?
That's a great question. I think our allocation reflects two things. The first is a fundamental belief that running a global fund and having more than 50% in any one country probably is an oxymoron, frankly. And just because the benchmark happens to have such a large weighting to the U.S., we probably wouldn't do that because we value diversification very highly as an effective risk management tool for our clients. But I would say the second point that you made is, or the point that you made is, and it would be my second point, and that's that actually the US isn't looking very cheap on a global basis, whereas areas like the UK and Europe are. And so it's unsurprising to us that even though we're bottom-up stock pickers and everything we do is driven by fundamental work on a company-by-company basis, when we aggregate all those positions together, we end up with a much bigger exposure to areas like Europe, emerging markets, the UK, than we do to the US, you know, certainly with respect to their global market caps.
Your thoughts on that, Simon, that bigger allocation to the UK and Europe?
I think the first point is absolutely right. The fact that a global index is 50%+ one country, and that economy is only about a quarter of the global economy, has always struck me as a little bit weird. But I take the point as well. The US economy has been ahead of Europe post the crisis of 08, 09, and done incredibly well. And we spoke a moment ago about results coming through. But I think the next sort of strong places coming through is going to be Europe. Not necessarily all of Europe, as Nicholas is saying, it's a case of finding your territories, finding your stocks. But I think there's probably a lot more value lurking around in the Europe markets in the UK than there is in the US, which has had a spectacular run over the last 6 or 7, 8 years.
Yeah. So Nicholas, this is a feeder fund. So investors in South Africa are investing in rands, and obviously lots of exposure to the euro and to the pound, and to a lesser extent to the dollar. How does that affect the performance of the fund for the South African investor?
I think over time, you know, the trend is clear in terms of, you know, people looking to allocate offshore and so on and so forth. That long-term emerging currency trend, people will, take their own view and their own advice on that, but we kind of see a long-term trend there. I think when it comes to currencies more broadly within the fund, we don't take currency positions. We think that over the five-year holding periods that we have for the underlying stocks, these things tend to even themselves out. And additionally, there are some very complicated underlying currency exposures that exist within the companies themselves, particularly large companies like Anglo American, where the business itself has very big transactional currency exposures. So we try not to overcomplicate this. We're simply picking stocks, and over time, the evidence seems to suggest that the currencies will even themselves out, and we'll do well off our stock selection, hopefully.
Is your performance, though, measured in RAND terms? And if so, then it must make it difficult to track or to match the benchmark, particularly last year when we saw the RAND so strong.
Yeah, I mean, the fund mirrors a product that is listed in Luxembourg and is a kind of offshore dollar currency fund. So that conversion into Rand is mechanical, and it's one that we do for the provider for ABSA. So we're not taking a view on that structure. It's one that clients seem to want in South Africa, and we're happy to provide it. But we think of the functional underlying currency of the product as US dollars.
Okay. And take us through the fee structure, because I see there's a different fee structure for your Class A and the Class R fund. So obviously one will have performed better than the other, given the higher fees for the one fund.
Yeah, I mean, we provide an underlying fund to our client, to ABSA, and they then sell on to their underlying client based on the access to the fee class that most suits your situation and your relationship with the business. For us, we're just happy to provide a kind of sensibly priced product that reflects the value that we're adding and perhaps hopefully over time will allow the underlying clients to do better. You know, there are a lot of kind of very, very expensive products out there, and perhaps we don't agree with that kind of, you know, hedge structure where you end up paying very, very high fees.
Okay, and we have to leave it there. Nicholas, thank you very much for joining us. Quickly, Simon, sensible pricing, worth the money?
I like the strategy. I like conviction, and there's conviction here. You can see it in the financials. Maybe it's wrong, but in time we'll tell. But I like fund managers to have conviction.
Good. Absolutely. Thanks again to Simon Brown, founder of Just One Lap, for his input. Also to Nicholas Kerridge, he's equities fund manager at Schroder, for his insights as well. Thanks to you for watching. Same time next week. Goodbye.